Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are here, and Judge Rovner is here also as a member of our panel, who is appearing by video, so the lawyers will see her at the podium, and we have her right in front of us. So good morning, also Judge Rovner.
Good morning.
Our only case for this morning is Ward against Neal, and Ms. Donnelly, we'll hear from you whenever you're ready.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Obviously, I'm here to discuss Mr. Ward's one and only claim, and that is about the ineffective assistance of counsel at the one and only phase of this trial, the penalty phase. And what is different about this case, very unusual about this case, is that it's not tethered exclusively to counsel's failure to collect, say, the central state records or interview other witnesses. It is about what counsel actually did, which was present highly aggravating evidence on behalf of her client. She portrayed her client through the two expert witnesses, Dr. Friedman and Dr. Parker, as an incurable psychopath, someone who was born without a conscience, according to them, incapable of feeling normal human emotions, incapable of feeling remorse.
So let me ask you this. In general, she's trying to raise a claim of mental incapacity, in a way, I'll say mental disease or so. But trying to show the jury that he has those failings was one of the strategies available. If she had tried to show he was autistic, it would have been the same thing. Autistic people have flat affect. They don't relate to other people. They don't have at least the ability to demonstrate normal emotion. So yes, the word psychopath may be maybe a troubling word, but she's trying to tell the jury that this wasn't somebody like you or me just who decided to go out and commit this ghastly crime.
Well, that may have been what she was trying to do, but there are some problems there. First of all, the research on the effect that psychopathy has on jurors is very sound and very strong. They consider it aggravating because it suggests that this person is going to be a future danger. I don't know of anything similar with respect to autism. And a person with that type of disorder may indeed have a lot more sympathetic qualities and options available to them than, say, someone who is incurable, a psychopath, and born evil.
Is your big complaint about the use of the word psychopath? Because at the post-conviction stage, antisocial personality disorder and other milder terms, or just different terms, I'll say, I'm not sure if it's milder, but other terms were used. So is it really just about this word?
Well, the word itself does have a connotation in the community that antisocial or autism does not have. So there is something about the word. But no, it's not just about the word. It's what the doctors said about Mr. Ward and how far they went. I mean, they went to the point where they were suggesting he was enjoying the trial. They suggested that he would be a danger in prison without any evidence to suggest that that's true. And Dr. Friedman even incorrectly said that there was research suggesting that it was true. So it's not just the word. It's everything that they said about the word, everything that a jury was likely to infer from the way that they described this person. They dehumanized him.
Ms. Donnelly, apart from Judge Jacoby, what significant witnesses did the mitigation investigation that was conducted for purposes of the post-conviction hearing disclose that were unknown to the defense at the time of the second trial?
She did not get... Well, two things. She did not get the central state records, and that showed that he had been diagnosed with a compulsive disorder, that he had wanted treatment, and he is quoted as saying he really wanted to get help. So that created a very different picture of him. She also did not apparently, at least according to some of the testimony of the witnesses, interview them, Don Scott, or other witnesses regarding Mr. Ward's traits that went beyond those that suggested psychopathy. So Don Scott testified to that, for example. There was also a teacher, that other information about his learning disabilities and so forth that she didn't explore and talk to.
Would you agree that had the words antisocial personality disorder been used, that there would have been evidence to show that that is something that psychiatrists view as untreatable as well?
Well, actually, Dr. Friedman specifically testified that antisocial personality disorder was different, less severe, and treatable, something that could be changed.
But couldn't somebody say that he wasn't suffering from the less severe, whatever label you want to put on it, you know, just like a really bad case of antisocial personality disorder or a more severe case to which a different word is attached? I'm not sure why the decision of the Indiana courts to accept these more severe characterizations is error.
To accept?
Well, I mean, so the Indiana court decides that the use of the word psychopath isn't in itself a reason to require another round of this. They do have all of these questions, and there does seem to be a lot of evidence that he's a person with very serious problems.
Well, he does have very serious problems. One very serious problem is that when he was 8 years old, he started compulsively exposing himself, and that subjected him to ridicule and shame as a child. And he has a very severe learning disability. He has a low IQ, but those are not in the same category as...
My biggest question for you, frankly, is even if I were to agree with you that there were deficiencies at the second trial in the lawyer's performance so significant as to meet the first part of Strickland, the Indiana courts all say that there was no prejudice from whatever deficiencies in investigation, deficiencies in presentation there might have been. And as you know, Harrington against Richter tells us that we review a determination like that with a great deal of respect for the way the state court evaluates the evidence. How can we say they were wrong?
Well, first of all, the Indiana Supreme Court failed to consider that there was any harm done by the presentation of the psychopathy evidence, because not only did it add aggravation, significant aggravation, to the scale, it also undermined any mitigating facts that were presented.
I read it to say, we just don't get how there could have been any prejudice in light of the record, the full record that was before the second jury.
In light of the crime, there is no such thing as a mandatory death penalty.
It's not mandatory. I mean, they're certainly looking at all of the facts. I can't see them saying, well, you know, you tortured and mutilated, therefore you get the death penalty. They went into much more detail than that.
Well, they said that the crime had very, very high weight and that there was nothing that could possibly outweigh it. And they don't...
Was there ever a convincing explanation for why Mr. Ward's criminal behavior suddenly escalated from exhibitionism and... I guess burglary, and some domestic violence to such a brutal and heinous rape and murder? I understand that there was testimony about the stressors in his life and his lack of coping mechanisms, but was there additional context that was ever offered for why he was capable of this crime if, in fact, he wasn't born this way?
Because, the disorder that he suffered from, the one that everyone agrees he suffers from, the compulsive exhibitionism, something he couldn't control, he desperately wanted to control, he desperately wanted to fix it, he was not getting the help that he needed, and over again he was getting in more and more trouble. He was constantly in a situation where he was on probation, I think, by that point in three different states, and his life was falling apart. He was immature, unable to take care of himself in any way. He hadn't been through much school. He had parents who were had their own problems. And this is just someone who, I mean, I don't know that we ever get an absolute clear nexus, and I don't think that you're required to show
that. Well,
that's
the thing. There isn't. I'm looking at Part 2, capital E3 of the Indiana Supreme Court's opinion on post-conviction, where it says, we sum up and weigh all the evidence as follows, and then it goes through mitigation on one paragraph and aggravation on the other paragraph. I don't see a word there saying there's nothing that could have been said. They look at what's on both sides, and they finally say, after weighing the totality of the mitigating evidence against the evidence in aggravation, etc., they don't see any reasonable probability that the post-conviction evidence would have changed anything. How do we say that's so far out of bounds that the standards set forth in 2254 are met?
Because they didn't consider the absolute harm, the weight that was caused. This is, it is as if
how can you say that? I mean, I don't know.
They don't even acknowledge that it was harmful for her to present psychopathy to begin with. It's as if.
But they may not have thought so. They may have thought, look, she tried. Or it was the first trial lawyers tried, and this is mentioned actually in the Indiana court's opinions, to say that he's actually not the monster he seems to be. He was nice to his grandfather. He had other redeeming features. He gets the new trial actually because of venue, not because of anything else, but he gets a new trial. It's handled by the same lawyers who do the appeal in the first trial, so presumably they know that record, and they think, well, that didn't work. You know, let's try mental disease, you know, that he's a psychopath. Now, you can sit here, maybe I can sit here and think, boy, that sure didn't work. You know, people aren't terribly taken to psychopaths, but they didn't have many cards to play.
The first trial was reversed because the community and the jury was so biased.
Yeah, so I'm saying hostile. It was a venue problem. They didn't grant the change.
They said they wanted him hung or shot at the immediately.
Yeah. No, I get it.
So assessing what did not happen or how strong the mitigation was or those factors from that first trial based on that jury wouldn't have made any sense. It's also not what counsel did, and the first trial was not complete either. So I don't think when you look at the first trial, there were two lay witnesses, mom and dad. Dad was dead by the time of the second trial. Three mental health experts that gave inconsistent testimony with one another, something pointed out by the prosecution. You know, there were certainly factors in there that Ms. Youngcourt said she wanted to follow through on. And she intended to do that, but she didn't. So I don't think we can look at the first trial as a gauge for looking at the reliability or the prejudice for the second trial.
Hello.
Yeah, sorry.
I'm so sorry to interrupt, and I know there's a bit of a delay, so it makes it difficult for you. But, you know, this was such a horrific crime committed under circumstances that show planning, a skill, such obvious dangerousness on Mr. Ward's part that it begs the question whether the defense theory that was presented at the post-conviction stage, though obviously it was more, more nuanced and humanizing than the theory that was presented at the second trial, but where could it have ever offered any realistic likelihood of a different result? How could there have been a different result?
There are cases where people have committed a severe crime, terrible crimes. Christopher Stevens' case, murdered a 10-year-old little boy, tried to smother him, tried to while he was saying, I love you, after having molested him 35 times. There are many capital cases have very, very severe facts. Rompilla's case had very, very severe facts. He was also found guilty of torture and or as an aggravating factor, and future dangerousness were found as aggravating factors in that case. That doesn't rule out the possibility that a jury, unencumbered by the having two prosecutors, is basically what happened here, couldn't find reason for mercy. One juror says, if this had been my kid, I would have moved heaven and earth to help him. If this had been my child, I would have made sure that he got the help that he needed. I would not have let him suffer for this long. He needed a pill. He needed antidepressants. His disorder is treated with antidepressants and was being successfully treated in prison with antidepressants. Dr. Cunningham at the first trial pointed out this man had been incarcerated, had never had incidents of violence in prison, and that that was the best predictor. There was abundant evidence that could show that this person, who was repeatedly described as like a child, Goober was his nickname, was someone that was worthy of sympathy. And when you have a case where the first trial is a biased jury, the second trial is one where counsel is literally acting as a prosecutor, to assume that this is standard mitigation, mitigation that does work in other cases, mitigation that jurors can relate to, could not have made a difference, is unreasonable.
So I thought at the second trial, though, actually quite a bit of the evidence elicited in post-conviction about his the deficiencies of his parents and his attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, learning difficulties, the exhibition, it comes out, maybe not in quite as nicely packaged a way. So the second jury does have before it those kinds of facts too. It's just not persuaded to recommend life in prison without parole.
It's absolutely, a lot of it was presented to the jury, but they were told that he was born without a conscience. Why would it matter? Who cared what his parents were? They literally told them, this doesn't matter, this exhibitionism had nothing to do with it. He is a monster. He is born without a conscience. He is not capable of human emotions. Anything that was inconsistent with that, they ignored. They explained, well, he said he experienced regret. Well, that's what psychopaths say.
We don't know that they ignored it. I mean, actually, if they thought he had a conscience and he did this crime, they might have thought that was even worse. I mean, I don't know what they thought, of course, but it doesn't seem to me it's a one-way possibility.
Well, I think that the way that they testified shows what something that's done a lot of times when, I mean, psychopathy comes up in criminal trials almost always by the prosecution, and defense counsel are used to looking at this. And one of the things that is very subjective, they tend to ignore any evidence that is inconsistent, is somehow relegated to, well, he must be lying or he's being manipulative. You know, that's what happened here. That's the way they are portraying him. And if you look at that evidence and you see the picture of the monster, the picture adopted by the prosecutor that is portrayed here, how could you possibly give effect to any other mitigating evidence that you could have discerned from, you know, the other things that came out in bits and pieces throughout here? Certainly the evidence trying to show he wouldn't be a future danger was undermined by the experts very directly and very clearly. Also the evidence of his family, I mean, you know, when his mother said something like, you know, yeah, he loved Dawn Scott, he had his long relationship with her and so forth, the experts said, well, that couldn't be really love because he's a psychopath. So I don't think that's part of the problem. It doesn't matter.
Of course, even her testimony is equivocal. She's not giving him a full endorsement.
Ms.
Scott.
Dawn Scott. Well, her testimony is that she has been his friend for a very long time, which is true, and that she is someone that he had a lot of very good qualities. They also thought he was very immature, and yeah, he had some bad qualities, and that comes out, and certainly as the Supreme Court has said, sometimes we have little facts that come out that, you know, aren't always positive. That doesn't necessarily undermine the case, and if that is all that had happened here, that would be fine.
I would like to go back, if we might, to something that I really, you know, have been thinking about quite a bit. And that is that I gather there wasn't any real disagreement among the five defense experts that have examined Mr. Ward, that he does suffer from antisocial personality disorder. Am I correct?
Well, no. Actually, the first time he was diagnosed with either antisocial personality disorder or psychopathy was at the second trial. There were three experts at the first trial. They all evaluated him. None of them diagnosed him with that. And any expert that he had seen prior to this in Central State or these other treatment connections with treatment programs, he didn't actually participate in most of them, but no one had ever diagnosed him with that before. And that was conceded by both Dr. Parker and Friedman. The difference is, and I want to make it very clear, I'm not suggesting that antisocial personality disorder in and of itself is a mitigating factor. I'm not saying the bad thing she did here was put up psychopathy and she should have just put up antisocial personality disorder. There was a much more complete picture.
Before.
Yes. Yeah. And what they said about antisocial personality disorder at the second trial, they didn't focus on it. In fact, at one point the state actually had complained during cross-examination, why don't you talk more about antisocial personality disorder? And so I think that they explained it in a way that this is a pattern of antisocial behavior. We have to look at the causes of that behavior. He had ADHD. That causes antisocial behavior when you're a child. He had a learning disability. He had this exhibitionism. Look at what is, and the family dynamics, look at what is causing the antisocial behavior and not just relegate him to a label. And they certainly said very clearly they did not think he was born that way.
Well, but I'm going to go back to, say, the overall performance of the lawyer, because we don't pick out one thing or another thing. They do put Aiken on the stand, who's quite clear that in his view, and he's got a lot of experience, a very good witness, in his view, Ward can be managed in a high-security prison setting. So whatever the psychiatrists or psychologists may have thought, you have a professional correctional person saying, sure, you know, we can manage guys like Ward, and doesn't seem to vary when he says that.
Well, he doesn't seem to vary, but the research, first of all, shows that the jury was likely to give more weight to the psychologist and psychiatrist.
Well, the lawyers can only do what they can do, but they put evidence in the record that says he's manageable. So the jury has before it, again, it's not like you or me coming, it's a highly experienced professional in the corrections business in Indiana who knows, presumably, what facilities are there and what measures they can take, says it's going to be okay. If you don't give this guy the death penalty, he's going to be controlled. And, you know, I don't know what else you can ask the lawyers to do, even if the jury might think that this is a disgusting crime and that they're going to punish him.
I think we could have asked her not to put up two psychiatrists and psychologists that said, one of whom said inaccurately that research suggested that what Mr. Aiken just told you was not true for a very small subset of individuals, and one of them is Mr. Ward, which is basically that he is going to be a danger. He is likely to be a danger in prison. That was inaccurate information, and
Parker
he told him.
Parker says that, doesn't he?
That was Friedman. Parker said that he was likely to escape, try to escape, and he would not be dangerous unless it was with a woman or someone he could overpower, I believe.
Parker also said,
yes.
Said something like, well, he's okay as long as you don't take your eye off him.
Yes.
Or something.
They both of them. suggested. Yeah. So I don't see how that's a consistent presentation, and I don't see how Mr. Aiken's objective point of view of what we can control people in prison is going to trump their point of view, which they are claiming is coming from their own.
But that sounds a lot like de novo review to me, I just have to say. Here's where it is, on page 14 of your brief. Parker says, Ward would only be a threat in prison to someone smaller or weaker than himself, or perhaps if he could catch someone in a moment when he had the upper hand, which sounds like pretty much always, when he's out of his cell. Now, if he's in his cell 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, then I guess that's not a problem.
Okay. I didn't understand the question about de novo review.
Well, I mean, the kinds of things you're saying about reweighing the evidence are disturbing to me only in the sense that that's not our role at this point. We need to look at what somebody else did and see whether what they did is supportable by the evidence.
I think the Indiana Supreme Court's factual findings and their decision to look at this by viewing psychopathy as a mitigating factor without taking into account the kind of aggravating effect it most certainly had in so many different ways on this case is unreasonable. And at that point, de novo review is all you can do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. If you'd like to save you'd like for rebuttal, that would be
fine. I would like to do that. Thank you very much.
Certainly.
May it please the court. This court should affirm the denial of habeas relief because the Indiana Supreme Court reasonably determined that Ward was not denied the effective assistance of counsel.
Ms. Popey, on the facts of this case, or really any case for that matter, why was it a reasonable strategy to label Mr. Ward a psychopath? Doesn't that invite the very response that the state made in closing argument, which is to say that the only realistic thing you can do with a psychopath is to incapacitate him? Psychopath has a meaning that strikes any individual who's ever heard the word with terror.
Here, what defense counsel was dealing with was two traits of psychopathy that were present in this case that defense counsel couldn't do anything about, that they were present. First, that Ward was not remorseful at all about his crime and showed no emotion about his crime. And the second was, given the facts of this crime and his criminal history, that he would be a future danger to society. And so counsel did what one of the two things you can do when you have damaging evidence that you have to deal with is either confront it straight on or ignore it and wait for the other side to bring it up and then try to deal with it there. Those are both reasonable strategies. And what defense counsel did here was confront it straight on, explain what psychopathy was, and then offer evidence as to why the jury should still give him life without parole. So the remorselessness explain that it's not his fault. He was born this way, and the way he grew up made him to be someone who doesn't have emotion.
But there was evidence. There was actual evidence that he might still be capable of some type of regret or remorse, that he had been in the past. And doesn't a defense team have to develop and emphasize whatever evidence it has along those lines? Isn't that, wouldn't you agree that that is the first and most fundamental obligation of his attorneys, rather than to come out and suggest that he's incapable of such feelings? As I say, when there was evidence that the man was desperate at times in his life to have help, that he was capable of feelings of remorse and regret.
First of all, I think the evidence of that is subject to debate, but certainly counsel had to decide how to use that evidence, because it actually cuts both ways. Because if the defense counsel emphasizes that Ward is capable of remorse and capable of that, and then has to acknowledge he has no remorse for this horrific crime, that is likely going to be more damaging in front of the jury than presenting evidence that perhaps he could be remorseful at some point, because there's there's really no evidence that he was remorseful about this crime. The closest you get is his statement, I think, to Dr. Ferrer or Dr. Fabian, I forget which one it was, during post-conviction that he regretted the crime. But
what about his letter to the judge?
About that he had regret. Dr. Ferraro testified that even when Ward expressed these kind of feelings, that he realizes that it's not the type of remorse we other people feel. It's something that he needs to have or should have, and so even those kind of indicators of remorse don't fit with what the jurors were seeing, which every day in court he's emotionless, even when the graphic pictures are being shown and what he did is being described. He sits there emotionless, and that's what Stephen Ripster, one of the attorneys, actually spoke with six of the jurors from the first trial and asked them what did you think of the evidence, what were your impressions. And one of the things that the jurors were communicated to him were that we really were concerned because he sat there during trial and didn't offer any kind of emotion, no matter what was going on in trial, and so Stephen Ripstra knew that they needed to explain that to the jury in some way. They couldn't just ignore it because that was something that the jurors were going to be concerned about. And in that regard, I just want to clear up, there is a mistaken citation in our brief on page 9 and 22 in which we talk about Attorney Ripstra and Attorney Youngcourt looking at the first mitigation and deciding to take a different track. That's actually at pages 57 through 59 of the post-conviction record and at page 462 for Lorenity Youngcourt. We cited to 198, but that's wrong. I apologize for that. I also want to address...
Now we know that Ms. Rushton, whose life was absolutely falling apart, and who was assigned to prepare the social history, only spoke to 12 witnesses. She never got to the 40 or 45 other witnesses that Youngcourt had assigned her. And how do we deal with that as far as ineffectiveness goes?
I think what's telling about that is that in post-conviction, none of those witnesses were presented as witnesses who should have been presented. When you look at the motion for continuance in which Youngcourt says that we have 45 witnesses more we need to talk to, she lists some of what those type of witnesses were, and she says she wanted to talk to all the police officers and all the victims in all of Ward's public indecency cases that he had throughout his life.
I just ask you to review for me how that part of his history ever got linked up to this crime? The fact that he had these 32 instances or whatever the number was of the public indecency matters. Is there expert testimony that says that proclivity on his part was somehow related to his decision to knock on the door and tell the lie about the lost dog and so on?
I'm trying to figure out how it's
relevant and what it means, really.
That's a little bit difficult because there were different ways that different experts approached that. And so Dr. Davis at the first trial testified that he actually exposed himself to the victim and that maybe he went there to expose himself and then it escalated from that. But given Ward's account of the crime to Dr. Davis, which is very damaging, further counsel didn't decide to use that. So then when we see it really appears next is that counsel, in preparing for the second trial, says, we've never had any explanation as to how exhibitionism leads to this. In fact, Young Court said, exhibitionism, from all I know and what I've been told by experts, isn't violent. It's a nonviolent phenomenon. And so we need something to explain how this turned into violence. Now, Dr. Ferraro, at the post-conviction, you talked about it as being one of the stressors that then led to this picture of Ward, that he was just overwrought, and so because of all this going on in his life, yeah, mostly because of the criminal aspect, that he kept going to prison for exposing himself and committing burglaries and everything else. And so that was what led to him being very stressed out.
So Ward was in his 20s when he committed this crime?
I believe he was in his 30s.
Oh, in his 30s? I wasn't sure.
I do want to touch on Dr. Parker and Dr. Friedman's testimony about dangerousness in prison.
Yes, I'm concerned about that, because that's not what I would have expected to hear from a defense witness.
Dr. Parker, the page that you cited that is cited in their brief,
right.
His answer to the answer, could he be a danger to other prisoners? Probably not. His violence, that as I understand it, tends to involve people that he thinks are larger or more dangerous than the other person. He's not of those small but mighty people that are difficult to fight with. He's probably more likely to be a victim in prison than he is to be an offender in a fight. And then, would he be a danger to a female prison guard? You have to remember that there's a power differential, and he's acutely aware of that. The female prison guard has the power advantage over him. So Dr. Parker was testifying he wouldn't be a danger. And then Dr. Friedman, at page 1970, says he's a low risk that he would commit violence in prison. On cross-examination, the prosecutor brings him some reports about risk of psychopaths in prison, and Dr. Friedman actually downplays those, says, I don't think those studies really reflect, they're kind of broad-range studies that aren't really helpful. And if you look at, you need to look at the individual, and if you look at the individual of Ward, and he says on page 1975, he, given his background, would not be a danger in prison. So both Dr. Parker and Dr. Friedman's testimony about not being a danger in prison dovetailed with James Aiken's testimony that he wouldn't be a danger in prison. And those were really one of the two things that counsel was trying to convey to the jury was, we know that research shows that you're concerned about remorse and you're concerned about future dangerousness. He's not going to be a future dangerous in prison if you give him life without parole. And we can explain the remorse, that it's not his fault. He was born that way and had an environment that encouraged it, and so you can't blame him for the remorse either.
Yeah, it seems to me if what you had really been setting out to do is present a mental defect kind of case, and that's really what you're saying, because of perhaps the time stress on this lawyer who seems to have been very overcommitted as far as I can tell, and the failures of the investigator, that defense never really gels. I mean, she just kind of has to throw it in as it is because the trial court's stuck with the trial date. Now, that still leaves my other question, which is how does one deal with the Indiana Supreme Court's finding of no prejudice? But in terms of the performance, it seems like a fairly clumsy presentation of a mental defect.
My review of the closing argument, and I asked you to look at defense counsel's closing argument, she did the best she could with what evidence she had. She made the most compelling case she could to the jury. Now, it didn't.
But with what evidence she had? Now, had she had more time to put together a more coherent story of mental defect, which is part of it, which we see at the post-conviction?
Well, that gets to my other point, that would be that there really isn't any difference with the post-conviction testimony as the trial testimony. So given more time, they have experts who testify to the same things that the experts testified at the trial phase.
But in a less inflammatory way, Ms. Donnelly says.
Well, perhaps only because they are not pushed in any way other than to say, the Dr. Parker and Dr. Friedman, their assessments are totally consistent with ours. So, you know, pushing farther about what is exactly does that mean wasn't done. But if they would have been arguing, if they would have been presenting evidence to the jury, the state would have brought out the psychopathic features of Ward and more explored those. But they didn't need to on post-conviction because the experts were saying our assessment's the same.
Mm-hmm. I think something that you've missed is that at the post-conviction hearing, Judge Jacoby, who had been Ward's former counsel on that whole series of indecency charges, gave extremely important testimony about the remorse and the shame that Ward had felt regarding his criminal behavior. And related to that, you had the medical records from the state hospital evaluation of Ward that were apparently also missed in the original investigation that reveal how genuinely and how urgently Ward wanted to know what was wrong with him. So that type of evidence, it seems to me, standing alone, would be highly relevant to a jury's penalty determination in a capital case.
There's no doubt that it would have been relevant and available for trial counsel to present. The question is whether it was an unreasonable decision not to present it. And Judge Jacoby, while he did testify to remorse, it was in the context of him representing him while Ward was on bond for a public indecency, then goes out and commits three more public indecencies and has to go back to jail. And so he said at that point he was, you know, pretty sorry that now he's sitting in jail over this. But for all the times in which Ward says he wants help,
that's not what Judge Jacoby testified to. He testified to pure remorse and regret, not because, you know, he didn't testify that he was remorseful because he was sitting in jail. That's the spin that the state puts on it, and one expert.
And when you look at the times that Ward says that he wants help, all of those are followed up by him not following through with treatment being discontinued because he's not involved with it, Dr. Edwards' testimony during the second trial. So how much of a difference that would have made when the main argument that counsel was trying to put forward and trying to give the jury a reason to vote for life was that the fact that he wasn't remorseful about this particular murder is not his fault, and that he can be housed safely. And that was a reasonable strategy, as the Indiana Supreme Court found, and Ward has not shown that that determination by the Indiana Supreme Court is itself unreasonable. I just want to point out one quick thing about Don Scott, just a reminder about that relationship. That relationship was a sexual relationship when Ward was 16 and Don Scott was 12. So to talk about it as being they were in love and showed his emotion, you have to remember what type of relationship it was from the beginning, which was a crime in and of itself. So not sure how that shows that he shows emotions or anything else other than he seemed to prey on Don Scott as well.
I want to just go back for one moment, if I might, because what has bothered me is the Indiana Supreme Court's reasoning, which I think boils down to, so long as you talk to some reasonable number of witnesses in an investigation, 12 here, it doesn't matter who you neglect to talk to. And that notion has been debunked in quite a number of cases. And it seems to me that so long as you can show that defense counsel knew about other witnesses and other lines of inquiry that might have yielded favorable information and failed to follow up, you've got a fairly good case there for ineffectiveness. And of course, you know, we all know now that Young Court knew that the mitigation investigation was incomplete and missed very important information that could have helped the defense case against the death penalty.
Well, here, besides the blanket suggestion that by the mitigation expert and by Young Court that more could have been done, there has to be at least an indication of what more could have been done. And just to point out, it wasn't just...
I'm not saying, or are you, that they haven't shown what could have been done, the different experts that Judge Jacoby, for one, other witnesses. I mean, Miss Youngcourt begged for continuances over and over and over, said she wasn't ready, had six other death penalty cases on her plate. She was in a terrible pickle.
And she wasn't doing this alone. She had co-counsel Stephen Ripstra, who was doing a lot of investigation and legwork at the same time. She was using her husband, who was a retired sheriff's deputy, as an investigator to go out and find things. She did a lot of things of talking to people. Judge Jacoby was known to defense counsel, was listed on their witness list, and they decided not to have him testify. So what further investigation? There could always be more investigation. You could always talk to more people. But surely it's not the standard that defense counsel has to talk to anybody who has ever had contact with the defendant before they've done a reasonable investigation. And no, here...
I was going to say, I think one of the questions is, and I think you alluded to it a little while ago, is how much of a sense do we have of who didn't get pursued and what they might have said? You've indicated that some of them were people associated with the exhibitionism because... I mean, that's how you have to do it. You have to say, you know, I at the post-conviction, you know, I wasn't allowed to look at the following 15 witnesses, and had I been able to, they would have shown that he can show remorse, or they would have shown that this really is a disease, or they could have shown whatever they might have shown. And so I guess I'm interested in how good the record is on the missing pieces.
There really isn't any demonstration at post-conviction of a line of inquiry or witnesses that went undiscovered. The one witness that I can find that was presented at post-conviction that wasn't presented at the second trial was Don Scott's mother, who was going to testify to the same thing that Don Scott testified to, which was, I thought that they were a good couple, and I thought Ward was a nice boy. Which isn't an extra kind of piece of evidence. It's just cumulative of what Don Scott testified to. So there isn't that, unlike any of the Supreme Court cases that have found the investigation to be inadequate, where whole swaths of a person's life have gone unlooked at. That's not what we have here at all. If there are no further questions, we ask that you affirm the district court.
Judge Rovner, is that? Okay, thank you.
Mr. Kobe, intelligent He just ran away.
I'm back.
He's back. I was trying to find out if you had any further questions. If you do, please go ahead.
Well, I think you can run away.
All right. Thank you for coming back, Mr. Kobe. All right. Ms. Donnelly.
I think there were, some viable alternatives to talking about Mr. Ward's apparent lack of emotion. For example, parental modeling. His father was universally described as someone who didn't show emotions. Children learn from their parents, and that we didn't have to go to psychopathy to do that and say he was incapable of experience that feeling. The same with future danger. At the first trial, Dr. Cunningham reviewed every single prior conviction. He had a lot because he had been in jail for all these the exhibition charges and so forth. And said based on past performance, which he said based on his research, and he has done extensive research on predicting future dangerousness, that there was no likely, or it was very unlikely, that he would be a danger in prison, that he had not had incidents of violence based on this prior incarceration. And so there were alternatives to psychopathy. I would also point out that she didn't prove the one thing that they say, well, just that was so important here, which was that he was born this way, because there isn't any agreement among experts that there is such a thing as being born with this condition or any particular brain abnormality that is.
I was going to ask you, my recollection is nobody did brain scans or otherwise examined the physical makeup to see if there were odd lesions or.
They absolutely did not. Nothing. And they had to concede that. So if that was what she was trying to get out of this, she utterly failed to do it. And just to be clear, she did not have Judge Jacoby. She did not have the central state records. There were a few other witnesses listed in our brief, and she was asked on each one if this is the kind of information that you would provide. As I said at the beginning, the thrust of the claim is not just what she didn't do, but it's what she did in response to having not completed her investigation. And that certainly made a difference, because what she did nullified anything that she did. By presenting psychopathy, it nullified anything that she did present in mitigation. And in terms of Mr. Ward's, there's no data one way or other whether that necessarily proves that people who have this kind of problem, exhibitionism, clearly have different levels of severity. Mr. Ford's father had the problem. His grandfather had the problem. His father's response to this trial, the conviction, was to go out and commit another crime. So, but clearly it doesn't always, 100% of the time, lead to more violence. But there is evidence that it does sometimes do that for precisely the reasons that the experts at the post-conviction and at the first trial talked about, some of the experts. It is something he cannot control by himself. He was 28 years old when the crime... Yes?
Did you do any sort of research to see if psychopathy has been used as a defense in other death cases?
I cannot think of any case where it has been successfully used. Ms. Youngcourt did research prior to trial. She testified to this. It's Petitioner's Exhibit 37. It was the hearing on Dr. Friesman's $55,000 bill. She said she called around the country, not just in Indiana, but around the country, and could not find a single lawyer who would suggest how she could possibly do this. And it is definitely outside the mainstream of what any person would do, reasonable lawyer would do in a case, a capital case. But I do think that hearing about how that horrible condition, something he was born with, apparently, 8 years old is the first time he does it. He's 28 by the time this crime occurs. And hearing about how much he tried over and over again, how ashamed he was, how much he wanted help, and how no one was able to help him. And this is not someone who's capable. He's living it with his parents. He can't get a job. He's slow. He has a low IQ. He has disabilities. He has no education. Desperately wants help. Very much wants to do that and cannot get it. that is the kind of pressure, and it does in sometimes in other cases have led people to explode like this. So I ask this court please to reverse his death sentence.
All right, thank you very much, and we appreciate very much your assistance to your client and to the court. Thanks as well to the state. We will take this case under advisement. The court will be in recess.